This is Thinkinclusive. I'm Tim Villegas. Are you a gamer? I did not think I was a gamer until one day when a Lyft driver and I were having a conversation on the way home from the airport. And we started talking about all the games I played with my family. Board games, card games, games on our phone, including my slight Fortnite obsession that my son got me into. And we were sitting in traffic and he just looked back at me and said, "Dude, you're a gamer." I think gamers ultimately like to solve problems. And our guest today is laser focused on the link between games to STEM and how it can help schools embrace neurodiversity. We'll be right back after a short break.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Welcome back to Think Inclusive, our podcast that brings you conversations about inclusive education and what inclusion looks like in the real world. And a very special welcome to everyone watching on YouTube. For season 11, we are producing a few video episodes as we get close to the end of the season. And our plan is to have full video versions of each episode for season 12, and that's going to start in September 2024. Dr. Jody Asbell-Clark is an educational researcher with a master's in math, a master's of science in astrophysics, and a PhD in curriculum, teaching, and learning. She co-founded Educational Gaming Environments Group, or EDGE, at Turk in 2009, focusing on game-based learning, computational thinking, and neurodiversity in K-12. She has led national and international STEM education projects, including curriculum development, teacher professional development, and educational research. Jody is a co-founder of ND in STEM at Turk to foster inclusive STEM education and author of the upcoming book, Reaching and Teaching Neurodivergent Learners in STEM. Prior to her career in education, Jody worked as an onboard software verification analyst for IBM during the first 25 missions of the space shuttle, and later taught physics and astrophysics at the University of Illinois. In this episode, Jody discusses the importance of inclusive education in STEM. She shares her journey in STEM and how a teacher's support and encouragement shaped her career. Jody explains the link between neurodiversity and STEM problem solving, highlighting the unique talents that neurodivergent learners bring to the field. She also discusses her research on computational thinking and executive function, as well as the impact of game-based learning in neurodivergent learners. Jody's book, Reaching and Teaching Neurodivergent Learners in STEM, provides strategies for embracing and supporting these uniquely talented problem solvers. Before we get into today's conversation, I want to tell you about this week's sponsor, the Autism Society. With 1 in 36 children diagnosed with autism, the Autism Society of America is dedicated to creating connections, empowering everyone in the autism community with the resources needed to live fully. As the nation's oldest leading grassroots autism organization, the Autism Society and its approximately 70 affiliates serve over 500,000 people each year. By championing initiatives that advance equitable opportunities in healthcare, education, employment, safety, and public policy, the organization executes a national reach with meaningful local impact. Through education, advocacy, support, and community programming, the Autism Society works toward a world in which everyone is connected to the support they need when they need it. For more information, go to autismsociety.org. The connection is you. And now my conversation with Dr. Jody Asbell-Clark. Jody Asbell-Clark, welcome to the Think Inclusive podcast.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I don't think we've ever had anyone on that specifically had any sort of STEM background. So this is...
Wow!
This is great. I'm so excited to have you on because this is a huge part of our educational, you know, community is the STEM community. And I think, you know, educators are in schools right now and, you know, maybe there's a STEM classroom, a STEM program. I mean, my daughter is a senior in high school and she is in the STEM Academy. So it's like the STEM is everywhere.
That's great.
You know,
that's great. Yeah.
So to get us started, Jody, what specifically got you into STEM or STEM related activities?
It's so funny you asked that because it's been a long time. I was thinking about it. It really was a teacher. It's a math teacher in high school. I went to high school in the 70s in Connecticut where things were pretty loosey-goosey at the time. And, you know, and I came from a creative family who valued education, but not necessarily mainstream education. And so I liked things outside of school more than in school. And I had a tendency to not necessarily go to school all the time or go to my classes. And a math teacher, Mr. Tenza, would come find me when I wasn't in class. And he would come bring me back to class because he saw a talent I had in math. And he wasn't going to let it go to waste. And he said, I don't care what condition you're in, what place you're going to come to my class. And he made it fun for me and he made it challenging. So I stuck at math and I just, that was the impetus. But then when I saw what math opened my doors to, and I had a co-op at IBM and I ended up at working on the space shuttle program. For the first 25 missions of the shuttle. This was both a co-op during undergraduate and then right out of undergraduate. That was my first job. And I wanted to be an astronaut. But not, lo and behold, my eyesight and maybe a little bit of my not-so-disciplined past kept me from the astronaut training program. But what I did was... What it did do for me was realize that through physics and math and computer science, there was a whole exciting world out there that I loved. And I have to say, being a female in those sciences at that time, for many of my compatriots, it was discouraging. For me, it was a challenge. I have three older brothers. I always wanted to keep up with the guys. Nobody's to tell me I couldn't do something because I was a girl. So that was a bit of an added spice to it for me. And truth be told, I got fellowships that I might not have gotten if it weren't just based on my grades. They were based on being a woman in science. And it just, the path unrolled for me very nicely. And it was always fun and always exciting. So.
I love that. Well, I love teachers, number one. You know, like the fact that you had a teacher pursue you and see something in you that it, you know, and it cultivated that love for math, right?
And I want to add that I'm not like some magic talented math magician or something. It was not my extraordinary talent. It was just there was some talent, and he didn't want to see it go to waste.
Yeah, yeah. And then second, you know, I think, you know, teachers just in general play a huge, you know, part in people's lives. Like, I think I can look back and I can name, you know, I can name my kindergarten teacher, you know.
Yeah.
And it didn't have anything to do with you know, STEM or anything, but I can definitely remember her and how she made me feel,
the community we had in that class, and then looking back and going, this person poured into my life, this person poured into my life. So anyways, just so grateful for teachers. And it just, when you said that, it just reminded me of that.
Well, and it also, I write about this in my book that we'll talk about. There's such a tie between emotion and learning and emotional investment and agency and learning. And again, I went to school during the 70s, and my elementary school, actually probably some during the 60s, was just in the time they were experimenting on open education. So most of my education, public school education in Connecticut, was pretty traditional. But some of it, they were trying new things. And we did this thing where for a month, we had a school project to create a toy for the school fair. And we got to choose the toy, design it. We went to the lumber yard and picked out the wood that we were going to use. They were letting us use jigsaws and all this. I'm not sure that would happen now because we had no training. But we did it from, you know, soup to nuts. And we marketed them. We did the whole economy, economic analysis of what, you know, market analysis for them, what we could charge, all that kind of stuff. And we chose where the money that we earned would go as a community service, like everything we did as a class. But I can't tell you what I did in the other days of my public school education, but I can tell you minute by minute what we did during that activity.
Oh, my goodness. And that was when?
I was grade six, so 1971, probably.
Wow.
It's 70 or 71.
That would be considered progressive now.
Yeah, it was really cool. And I remember it so much. And it's the smell. It's the smell of the sawdust. It's the feel of the wood. It's, you know, it's that sensory and emotional investment I had in that activity that really brought it home.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's amazing. That's amazing. Yeah. So one of the things about STEM, and I want to relate it to either your book or talking about EDGE or however you want to, is that, you know, this connection with inclusion and really talking about all learners, you know, STEM and other kinds of, you know, maybe gifted and talented or however you want to say it. Sometimes, seem exclusive, you know, you know, meaning like students are quote unquote handpicked or,
you know, but not bad good.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So, how does this idea of all learners inclusion, relate to STEM and the work you're doing?
Well, I want to tell you a little bit of a story of how I got here. So I've been doing STEM education, and I work at Turk, which is a nonprofit focusing on equity and opportunities and innovations in STEM education. And so I've been doing that all along, got involved in game-based learning. Some colleagues of mine in 2009 founded EDGE at Turk, the Educational Gaming Environments Group, to reach those kids who weren't necessarily interested in school, kind of like my story, but had good learning to do. And through that, we were noticing kids that didn't necessarily perform academically sometimes became rock stars at learning. You know, sometimes they were the ones that figured things out first. And other kids went to them and went, hey, how'd you do that? And then their identity started shifting and just their stature in the class. And then they'd try to take more risks. So it was a snowball effect. As soon as they saw themselves as good learners, they became good learners. So we first saw that in games. In around 2015, we started researching a game called Zumbinis, which was created by Turk back in the 90s. I was not on the development team, so I can honestly tell you it is the best learning game out there. It's an awesome game. It's been out for a long time. You can get it in the App Store. And Zumbinis was designed to think about the organization of databases or some crazy esoteric idea, but mostly about how you solve problems computationally. Now, in 2020s, computational thinking is this huge thing in K-12 education. People are realizing that thinking algorithmically and thinking about patterns and breaking down problems into smaller problems that can be solved in routines and all these kinds of things is the way of problem solving of our future society. So it's becoming a big thing in K-12 education. Well, that's what Zumbinis is all about. We started doing research to demonstrate how we could both develop and measure computational thinking through this gameplay. And lo and behold, again, the teachers were coming up to us going, oh my gosh, my kid who's on an IEP that has really low performance and everything else, they race through these puzzles. And everybody wants to be in their group to know how they're doing them. So we started looking at the overlap between computational thinking and STEM problem solving in general, but computational thinking is a very logical approach to problem solving, and neurodiversity, what we call neurodiversity. We define that as just the natural variation in human brains, but it often plays out in IEPs in school with autism, ADHD, dyslexia, combinations of all those, anxiety, trauma-related things, all kinds of reasons for neurodiversity. But often it comes down to executive function, working memory, attention, but cognitive flexibility and self-regulation, metacognition, these kind of core processes that our brains use when we're solving puzzles or goal-oriented tasks or doing schoolwork or our work. And we really dug into the research there and started seeing that researchers in autism like Simon Baron Cohen have been saying for decades, there's something systematizing about a brain with autism. They say these are great generalizations, but they're founded in some of the research. There's connections between creativity and ADHD. And dyslexia, there's the idea generation process and looking at big picture ideas can be really linked to the differences in brains that cause some of those other things that we call conditions, or I don't use the word disorder, but differences. So these talents that are that come along with some of the struggles that neurodivergent learners have often align with STEM problem solving. As I said, pattern recognition, systematic thinking, abstracting routines into bigger, but not abstracting ideas into bigger ideas. These are what scientists have to do to innovate and solve problems. So scientists and mathematicians and engineers, STEM problems. So looking at that, we've started researching how do we actually support executive function in STEM in such a way that not just remediates or adapts. But not, how do we seize those assets? How do we highlight those assets that neurodivergent learners may bring to STEM while supporting their executive function? But not, so that's what we're about. I can tell you the projects we've done.
So how does that play out? What does that look like for learners? Yeah.
So most recently, for the last 4 years, we've been funded by the U.S. Department of Education's program called EIR, Educative Innovative Research, something like that. And we had generous support from them for a project called Including Neurodiversity in Foundational and Applied Computational Thinking.
It's always got to be an acronym.
That's right. So this is for grades 3 through 8. And we developed computational thinking activities, robotics and coding and puzzles and games and get up and move around, acting out activities all around computational thinking. And we specifically embed supports for executive function. So we have graphic organizers for working memory. We have highlighting tools to highlight salient information and guide attention. We have metacognitive tools so that we have lots of time for reflection and explicit articulation of what you just did and what you just learned and where you are in the process and what you can do now that you couldn't do before. And these are both teaching strategies and embedded digital supports in the activities. We put out, I think there was something like 189 different activities, different combinations. Other things we do is we have multiple entry points to an activity so that teachers can differentiate and multiple representations, multiple modes of input and output. So we make it very flexible that teachers can have the same learning goal, but kids can enter it and proceed with it in different ways. And lo and behold, we found out that not only does everyone learn computational thinking better this mode than in the comparison mode, but that the kids who scored in the lowest third of executive function on executive function tasks had huge improvements in computational thinking in this curriculum, so much so that you can't really tell the difference between them and the other kids by the end. So that was our early phase research. The last 4 years, we've now applied for the mid phase to bring this up to scale and find districts that want to implement. We want to develop teacher professional development programs because teachers, while completely overburdened with everything else that's going on, are seeing this great influx of executive function needs and are recognizing for the first time the great influx of executive function needs in their classrooms and are being told, and there's this thing called computational thinking that you all have to infuse into all your curriculum now. So those are two very big challenges, but they're complementary. If they work with the computational thinking in the right way, they'll help address the executive function challenges. And if they help address the executive functions, they're going to make some really great, awesome computational thinkers.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
So for an educator who's like saying, oh, I need this right now, Jody, I can't wait, you know, another few years, like what can they do to bring this?
I'll give you all our URLs and everything at the end. But ND and STEM, neurodiversity and STEM is launching right now at TERC. TERC is TERC and TERC.edu. And within the next, well, by the time this podcast is out, I'm sure.
No doubt.
We will have it up there. And all these materials, the teaching learning materials, are open access. One thing the U.S. Department of Ed does, one of the many things the U.S. Department of Ed does really insists on equitable access of the materials that are paid, developed with taxpayer dollars. So we're putting them out there. We will have to probably have some kind of fee-for-service for the professional development just because we need to run it. And we'll have some. So that's what we're going to do in the next stage. But the materials are out there and we're always, you know, especially if there's a school or district that wants to implement it as a group, we'd love to talk to you because we'd like to do research on what happens when that happens. So.
That's amazing. So something came to mind when you were talking about all this. Are you a gamer, Jody?
No. By strict definitions, no, I am.
Okay.
Not.
Okay.
I love board games. I play board games all the time, card games. I became a video gamer when we were designing video games, so I knew a little bit about what I was doing. And I will tell you, there's a game called Portal that came out years ago.
Oh, I know that Portal. Yes.
And that game really changed my world as an educator. It made me see what it is like to go into a situation not knowing anything about how to solve that situation and how those designers scaffolded that experience so that when I came out, not only had I solved it, I could turn around and say, that is exactly what I just learned to solve it. And that's what I'm going to take to me with me to the next level.
Interesting.
So clearly crafted education.
Oh, okay.
And if you go into Portal and play it with the developer commentary on, change designers tell you how they did that all the way through. I wrote a paper about the learning science of the developer commentary in Portal. It never got published, but it is. I'll have to turn it into a blog post. You just reminded me because
you need to. Awesome. Full disclosure, I have never played Portal or Portal 2. And the reason I got to Portal was through the music of Jonathan Coulson, which is so strange. And I don't know why, like, I don't know how I got to it from there, but I'm a recovering musician. How do you want to say that?
Don't recover too much. You will keep that talent.
And so, I listened to a lot of music and I came across Jonathan Coulson's album, Artificial Heart, I believe it's the name of it. And there's a song on there. It's the ending song of the
Portal. Okay, the right.
And I was like, this is amazing. And then I just started going down this rabbit hole and finding the game and then, Portal 2. And I've always meant to play it. But I just don't have I need to get it on my PC.
Rainy weekend or, you know, God forbid you get laid out being sick, but you can still function. It's a great, because you can just binge on it for, you know.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so that really taught me a lot of the value of gaming as an educator and turned my head around and what I had seen that we were really getting going in this in 2009, 10, 11, when virtual worlds and Second Life was big. And we were able to reach people engage people in STEM who never thought of themselves as STEM people. We created an MMO game, massively multiplayer online game, in a world called Blue Mars. And we had 600 players engage about 100 of them for 4 months. And a couple of them put hundreds of hours into solving the scientific mystery we had set up. It was called Martian Boneyards, and we had discovered a science center on Mars, and there were lots of bones, and something had happened, and the community had to come help us figure out what had happened. It played out over 4 months. We were in there as avatars playing with them. We recorded all the analysis of the bones and the measurements and the analysis they did. And we had undergraduate anatomy professors rate their work. And they said it was basically a very good on an undergraduate introductory course scale. And these people were, our top two players. One was a recluse who did not leave her home and was not employed. And this was her change that she did. And one was a 52-year-old bus driver who had never gone past high school, and both of them said, "Oh, I'm a gamer. I never give up. If I have to learn science to solve this mystery, I'll learn science. I want to solve the mystery." And it was great. And then we developed high school tablet games based on Newton's laws and optics and some of the high school science. And we found kids were learning implicitly through the game. And then when their teacher came over and said, "Hey, you're putting more force on the heavy ones than the light balls. Let me tell you what Newton said about that." And those kids did better on exams of Newton's first and second law than if they hadn't played the game or hadn't had the bridging. So we saw games as a real vehicle to get from what happens implicitly to explicit STEM learning. And that's where I got into games.
I have a loose definition of gamer. So I when I hear you talk, I think you're a gamer.
Oh, thanks. Most of my team would laugh heartily at that because they really are gamers.
There is all this energy and focus being put into VR, so virtual reality, especially games. And I'm thinking, I still feel like we're at the beginning of all of this. We've had the internet for decades, but as far as how we can utilize virtual reality and not just for like everyday things, I know about some technology and applications being like you can put on your VR headset and go shop at Target or something like that,
Why?
I don't know. But to solve problems like what you were talking about, right? Being able to create these worlds where you could, solve these problems and learn and be engaged that way. Is that something that your team is working on or anything that you're thinking about?
Yeah. So we, my colleagues with whom I created Martian Boneyards, Tian Edwards and Jamie Larson, have a grant right now to develop a virtual space station outside Europa, Jupiter's moon Europa. And it's a bit of a science adventure game again. It's not a mystery in the way ours was before, but it's sort of like, I think, a little bit escape room puzzly, along with you're in a science center and you have a mission to accomplish. And they have this grant to develop this particularly for learners with autism, and particularly for any learners who have sensory attention and social differences. So on one thing we haven't talked about, our team does everything with nothing about us without us philosophy. And so we strongly believe in co-design. And with education materials, we co-design with teachers often. With these materials, we're co-designing with neurodivergent learners and neurodivergent designers. And so we work with Landmark College, which is a post-secondary institution for neurodivergent learners, and our other network And we can bring the people who want to work with us in on our design process and do all the idea and brainstorming with them, and then the user interface design. So it's not just like, oh, we developed this thing here. Do you like it? No, they're there from the ground floor. And it's fascinating because when Universal Access, which is this project that has the space station, they brought to the idea right from the start, the narrative of this game should be about communication differences and about let's have our creatures not communicate in the way the player necessarily will come immediately forthwith. Let's have some negotiation around that. They also, we did some research on that about noise and brightness. And we expected there to be some less tolerance of brightnesses for some neurodivergent learners and things. What we didn't expect was that the noise played out in two different ways. Some learners didn't want noise at all. Some performed better and preferred and performed better when there was a lot of noise. So, and there's some I'm speaking a little bit past my field of expertise here, but from what I understand of the neuroscience, there are some change reasons for that that could be because of undoing other kind of internal noise that's happening all in the brain. And so by creating a distractive noise, they actually can focus more. And so that's just fascinating. And so much of the design of those immersive systems need to take that into account. I personally can't wear a VR headset for more than about 3 seconds without getting nauseous. And that's also why I didn't become an avid gamer, is, you know, one of those big, you know, first person shooters running around on a big screen and I'm like out of there in no time. For more than one reason, but even if it was not violent, I just systematically can't handle it. But that sensory aspect, I think, is really fascinating. The ability to guide attention when you're in VR, all there is to focus on is what's there in your VR. So to be able to control that is an exciting opportunity for education. You know, we've been talking about it for a decade or more, and I haven't seen the, you know, rise, especially in VR, that everybody's predicted. So whether it's going to really take off before something else comes along, who knows? Yeah. There were some interesting things that happened during COVID where there was a platform called Verbella that we worked with that was a virtual world, so an avatar-based virtual world where many universities ended up opening campuses during shutdowns. And it became this live academic and business environment for a while. And I was in there and it was amazing. I went to a conference having been on these flat 2D Zoom conferences. And in Verbella, when everybody turns their head because the speakers, even if it's your avatar head, have the whole room turn to the speaker and have people get up and come to my table and be able to talk and then get up and go to another table and be, if there was something really neat, you know, and had a lot of potential. So, and then there's AR, augmented reality, which I think has a lot of potential. And I have a colleague, Zach Alstead, in our group who is using AR to detect when somebody's distracted from their eye gaze and their head position, and then figure out what kinds of prompts we can give them. This would be somebody who wants to stay on task but has trouble. And so what are their prompts we can give them to stay on task when we notice that they're being distracted? So there's a lot of those kinds of potentials that are there.
That sounds really familiar, but I don't know where I heard that from. I kind of heard you imply that sort of intervention is really, you know,
the person wanting that intervention as opposed to, you know, you need this.
Well, right. So one thing we haven't talked too much about is my book. And the thing that changed and really motivated me to write the book is I realized when we saw this link between computational thinking and neurodiversity, I went to look at it and I realized that since 2003, really, but certainly in the last decade, STEM companies, SAP, Microsoft, EY, these companies have realized this. And they've had these neurodivergent hiring programs. So I went to talk to them and said, well, you know, okay, so what's this about? And I really expected to hear the CEO has a nephew or, you know, like this kind of philanthropic, great reason, philanthropic reason. They're like, we are so past that. And then we want the talent. When we hire neurodivergent teams, we have a competitive advantage. That's the phrase they used. And whoa, they talk about it completely differently. They put together teams where somebody is the, you know, ultimate debugger because they won't quit until every last detail is checked, along with the idea generator who is, you know, coming up with 10 things a minute, along with the really social communicator. And that's a team that they'll put out to go consult on people's problems. And and they've trained and have hiring, say, revamped hiring programs and management programs to understand executive function. And when I asked them what they did, they say, well, you know, we put out like clear written agendas and we stick to the agenda. We make sure everybody has a chance to speak in the meetings. And then after the meeting, we put out lists of action items and decisions that came out from that meeting. I'm like, that's just really good. That's what like I would strive to do as a manager.
I know. That's so funny you said that. Yeah, because the parallel to the classroom is so clear.
Exactly.
Because it's like, you know, teachers for better or for worse have been teaching a particular way for, you know, let's say many years. And then if you have a neurodivergent learner, for it to be successful, you do have to change things. You have to like do things a certain way, be very clear, you know, have, you know, established routines and, you know, be very clear about communication. And that is good for everyone, it seems like.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. So what I wanted the title of the book to be is don't fix them if they're not broken. And that really is the message. They're not broken. They're different. We're all different. You know, I need glasses and, you know, and I interrupt people all the time, you know, it's the price of admission, as someone would say. But with that, you can get other talents and, you know, and that's what differentiation is all about. If you go into a classroom saying, I have a Cane Street classroom of 30 individuals, and I have the school behind me and the resources too, at the time too, really treat them like individuals. That's magic, right? That's when it works.
So that's what you wanted the book to be called. So it's not called that.
It's not called that. It is called Reaching and Teaching Neurodivergent Learners in STEM: Strategies for Embracing Uniquely Talented Problem Solvers.
Okay, well, we can have a secret subtitle then.
Yeah. Apparently, it's all about algorithms, which marketing algorithms, which I guess.
Before we move on, is there anything else you wanted to change about with the book? Because, I just want to make sure you had the chance to.
Yeah. Well. Thanks for that. So I'm really hoping that the book is written for educators, and I think it will be change useful in professional learning communities and schools and systems where people are trying to really understand inclusive education for what that can mean, and not just remediation, but it's helping everybody thrive. That's the point of it. It's also a very story driven book. I've interviewed, changed many, I think, I can't remember the names, but it's close to 100 neurodivergent STEM professionals and learners and families and employers. Dr. Sarah Seeger, who is a rock star in my mind, she's an astrophysicist who has an equation named after her, and a really, she's a MacArthur fellow, and she was learned she was autistic as an adult, and explains to me in these great ways why she would never change her brain. It is her superpower. She just wishes people wouldn't stigmatize it, and just a lot of, and district. I interviewed district superintendents about what it takes when the rubber meets the road to implement things. So I hope I provide a balanced perspective towards all that. It's, you know, after 30 years of research, there are no simple solutions. You only have more questions. But I think through the game-based learning, using things like computational thinking, and one thing we haven't talked about is project-based learning, which is a big part of my pedagogical philosophy. I was lucky enough to spend the 8 years voluntarily co-teaching it with a very close friend of mine now, but a STEM teacher in junior high school in a high needs school here in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And again, just like Portal, blew my whole world apart and in a great way, and just made me really understand change takes to do what we were just talking about, to think about, in this case, 23, 24 kids in your classroom as individuals. And they all had very different and profound needs. And changed. Sadie Bradbury, the teacher I worked with, changed, was just awesome at knowing how to make a personal connection with each and every one of them. And she and I changed together to engage them in STEM projects and engage them in discovering the learner within them and the doer. And I hope maybe affected a couple of them along the way to go pursue those passions and just to see themselves as competent STEM problem solvers and competent citizens of the world, because a lot of school doesn't always do that. Especially for some of the most marginalized kids. Kane,
it sounds like you and your, co-teacher, your teaching partner,
Kane,
really embraced all of your students and learners. So what can STEM classrooms / programs, you know, even educators in general, what can they do to embrace all learners?
So I think it goes back to those kind of multiple entry points into project. So let me just give you an example. When we do coding activities in something like Scratch, which is an introductory block coding, we might present three different ways to get into it. We might present an entire piece of code that somebody can then take and copy and change and make their own. Or it's a blank screen with an inventory and they can start from scratch. Or here's a piece of code that might work, but there's a little bug in it. So go figure out where the bug is. Or you might need to just sit and watch, not just, you might need to sit and watch somebody else model how they're coding for a little bit and then go. All those are valid ways into the task. They're not changing the task. They're not changing the goal. They're just giving everybody the entry point that they need to be able to do that. And a teacher can't have 24 different tasks. They need to have one learning goal, one task. But by giving them lots of different ways of, you know, not everybody has to write all their stuff down in a notebook. Somebody can record something on their phone and present it. Somebody can act it out. You know, there's all kinds of ways. One thing we did learn from the teachers in grades 3 through 5 in particular, the get up and move around activities where we reenacted digital games live, like kids would be the characters in the games and they had to do all the logic puzzles in physical instantiation. Teachers loved it. It got them away from the screens. They were still doing something fun. The kids that needed to move around had a reason to move around. Those were by far our most popular activities. And I just think thinking creatively of not about what the learning goal is, because that's pretty, you know, but how to approach that and giving teachers lots of options, lots of support, lots of time change. I'm going to tell you my last pet peeve. Don't interrupt the class every 10 minutes with an announcement or somebody coming in. Give the room a chance to get into flow. Change. Yeah. That is my biggest complaint about public schools right now, is there's no opportunity for flow. Change. In Canada, we have a show called This Hour Has 22 Minutes. And it's a comedy show, but it means that when you take out all the ads and everything, you're dead. And I named a chapter of the book that every period has 22, if you're lucky, minutes to teach when you get rid of all the other stuff.
Gosh. So I've never heard that before.
And it's not contiguous.
I bet you I would love that show.
Change. Yeah. So I just think there's, think about the learner when you're structuring the environment, and a lot of those things will become obvious.
Stay tuned after the break for the mystery question.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
What is the best thing to happen to you this year?
Wow.
What is the best thing?
Really crappy year to ask that question.
Well, then we're going to focus on the positive, I guess.
Okay. I can.
Best thing. Let me think about it.
What change
this year? I'm going to look it back in my calendar here. Let me think.
Change to.
Of course. Okay. Are you ready?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, go ahead.
I mean, clearly, professionally, finding out that the book was actually going to be published this year was a big one, because I really want to get that message out and get that out there. But I also, right around the same time, well, I turned in my final manuscript and left the next day for France. And where my husband and I go quite frequently, and changed COVID, having not traveled for, you know, several years, we scored the best Airbnb ever. And it had a rooftop terrace overlooking this Provençal village of Roussillon. And we spent every night up there on that rooftop terrace. And I just thought, changed. Yeah. This was, I hit it out of the park with this one.
That is amazing. Amazing. Well, not to diminish everything that has happened this year for me, because I've had a very good year, no complaints, professionally, personally. My wife and I are celebrating our 20th anniversary.
Congratulations.
At the end of September, and we are going to Spain.
Great.
And so I kind of feel like that is going to be the best thing that has happened.
Yeah.
This year. But it just hasn't happened yet.
Okay. Well, that's great. You still have
according to this.
And this weekend, you may be going to celebrate the women's FIFA World Champions because Spain.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Spain and
England.
And England. Wow.
And I would say that is also one thing. I had to leave playing soccer when I was 50, 51, because I tore my ACL. And this year, in the last few weeks, I went back out on the field 10 years later. So,
oh, great. And oh, my gosh.
That is also a great thing to, and in like walking soccer in a geriatric league. But it's.
No, I totally get that because, I'm a runner. I actually used to run quite frequently. And then this past year, like from, December till now, I just had a lot of issues with, back and knees and legs and all that stuff. But, I made some changes and trying some new things, and I was able to go for a 3-mile run a couple weeks ago, or a little over a week ago, with no pain and sore muscles, but I can live with that.
And that means you're working too.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So I'm really looking forward to get back to, running, and it's a huge part of my life. And so I get it. With the soccer, it's like, you love it, right?
Exactly. It starts to get back to me.
Yes, Bill Clark, thank you so much for being on the Inclusive Podcast. It was so much fun.
Well, thank you.
That chime means it's free time. And this week, some good news. It's not often where I look at the stories in Education Week and I see great examples of inclusive education. In fact, it's so good that I'm just going to read the entire piece for you. Here we go. Inside a School That Doesn't Single Out Students with Special Needs by Caitlin Peets. When students walk into Ruby Bridges Elementary School to start their day, nobody is pulled aside or separated from their peers to receive special instruction. There's no need. Everything at the school, from the seating to staffing, was designed to ensure students with disabilities can learn alongside their peers, transforming what has traditionally been a model of exclusion in U.S. public schools to one of inclusion and belonging. Ruby Bridges opened in 2020, and the staff at the Woodinville, Washington School I've spent the last 4 years creating an environment that conveys to every child who walks in, "We thought of you when we made this place, and today could not happen if you weren't part of it," said Principal Kathy Davis. So obviously we don't want you to leave the classroom to do something else, because then how could science class be the same, she said. It's this idea for kids that they are so important that something would be missing in a unique way if they weren't there. The K-5 elementary school, about 20 miles northeast of Seattle, serves just under 500 students. It's one of 16 schools in Washington State that partner with the Herring Center for Inclusive Education at University of Washington, with the goal of demonstrating that all students benefit when schools are deliberately crafted with the needs of students with disabilities in mind. At Ruby Bridges, staff have structured everything around the idea of keeping students with special needs in mainstream classrooms as much as possible. Instead of pulling students with complex needs into separate classrooms for lessons, specially tailored to their needs, they head to class with their peers. There, everyone has access to supports traditionally outlined in students' IEPs or 504 plans, like the ability to take breaks when feeling overwhelmed. Students may choose to wear lanyards around their necks with cards that display words and pictures so they can communicate with classmates who are not verbal. Some students may choose to learn in a group with the teacher, while others might work independently on a tablet with headphones on. Many students at Ruby Bridges, where about 16% of students are identified as having disabilities, can't communicate verbally. So every student has access to assistive communication devices, like speech boards or computers that synthesize speech from text. Our responsibility is to have a school with classrooms that are ready for kids, not a school where kids are forced to be ready for classrooms, Davis said. In practice, this means that students with disabilities spend 80 to 100% of their academic time with grade level peers. There are resource rooms students can use when they need a break for a specific one-on-one activity with a paraprofessional, but they are flex spaces with no set schedule. They are open to everyone, Davis said. Instead of pulling students out of class for extra help with phonics or other skills, paraprofessionals come to them. The same goes for English learners. And rather than having a designated paraprofessional assigned to each student who needs that level of support, paraprofessionals work with different students all the time. In the morning, they could be supporting an advanced math group and working with a different group on phonics in the afternoon. What's more, small group and intervention time is built into the calendar for everyone, so that when paraprofessionals come in to work with specific students, nobody is singled out. Everybody is working on something, and nobody is missing a whole class lesson. The setup reduces stigma that students may feel when they're singled out for extra help, David said. You see lots of adults everywhere, and it's because no one's working separately behind closed doors. And all of the adults in the school are communicating and collaborating to support all students, Davis said. Kids pick up on if one para only helps kids who are really struggling with one thing. So there's a very specific effort to make a heterogeneous mix. There is increasing evidence that work to create a full sense of belonging for students with disabilities, like what's happening at Ruby Bridges, benefits all students' achievement and social skills. Students with special needs perform better when they spend significantly more time in mainstream classrooms than in special education classrooms, according to researchers who, writing in the Journal of Special Education in 2022, found that the students who spent more time in mainstream classrooms were exposed to more rigorous coursework. Researchers have also found that the inclusion of students with disabilities in general education classrooms has resulted in students without disabilities learning how to respect others in gaining awareness and skills to help others. Several studies over the years examining these more inclusive practices have found either neutral or positive effects on all students' performance in core subjects like math and reading. Belonging matters for kids with disabilities in the same ways it matters for any other student in our schools. The difference is that belonging can be much more elusive for students with disabilities, said Eric Carter, the executive director of the Baylor Center for Developmental Disabilities at Baylor University, who has conducted extensive research on the topic. Only including students with disabilities in activities outside of class, such as recess and lunch, or including them in classes that aren't set up to accommodate their needs, isn't enough to foster a real sense of belonging and camaraderie, Davis said. The work has to be intentional. And it's often uncomfortable because it requires challenging the setup that has been the status quo for decades in many places. The payoff is incalculable, though, said Davis. The parents and families of students identified as having a disability are constantly going to meetings, being told how different their children are from an arbitrary set of norms, and all of the services they need that often mean having less community, Davis said. But we have a responsibility to create spaces where we don't make deep, impactful, lifelong decisions about the lives of our students will have before they even have an opportunity to make decisions for themselves. Partnership between the University of Washington and schools, including Ruby Bridges, was made possible by a federal grant to support more inclusionary practices in the state. particularly to reach that threshold where students with disabilities spend at least 80% of their time in general education classrooms, a goal driven by federal policy that requires students be taught in the least restrictive environment appropriate for them. About 2/3 of students with disabilities met the goal in the fall of 2020. According to the National Center for Education Statistics, markedly higher than the 32% who did in 1989. But Washington State has struggled to keep pace, with about 60% of students with disabilities spending 80% or more of their time with their peers in 2020. As of 2018, a report cited by the state officials ranked Washington 44th out of 50 in inclusionary practices, which prompted state lawmakers to earmark $25 million, spur improvements through professional development statewide, and more targeted support in pilot schools. Ruby Bridges is considered a demonstration site for the partnership with the university, opening its doors over the past 2 years to more than 350 visitors and observers who want to learn about best practices in teaching students in the least restrictive learning environment. The school models its work around the 10 dimensions of belonging, developed by Carter at Baylor, which began with allowing students with disabilities to be present, then invited, and ultimately accepted, supported, befriended, needed, and loved. Belonging is more than just being included or present in a space, Carter said. People want to experience belonging, and that's more than merely a location of classrooms or participation in clubs. It's about what students experience and the relationships that develop in those places. Monroe High School, located about 30 miles northeast of Seattle, is also part of the partnership with the University of Washington, working to foster belonging in school for older students with disabilities. Oftentimes, that means they arrive at the high school having spent their entire academic careers receiving much of their instruction apart from their peers in general education, said Principal Brett Willey. So when students with disabilities spend most of their time in a mainstream classroom, they get their dignity back, he said. When you have a kid in an exclusionary classroom in the corner of a school building doing first grade math problems, that doesn't give them a lot of hope or dignity, Willie said. But when you put these students with their peers, you're telling them you value them and you believe in them. Kids pick up on that. The model requires a shift in adult mindsets. Educators aren't responsible only for their classroom or a specific group of assigned students. Instead, everybody is responsible for every student. It can become a daunting perspective, Davis said. But once it becomes ingrained in the school culture, it can prove a rewarding environment for staff with an added benefit of less staff turnover, particularly among paraprofessionals who can be difficult to retain. In fact, paraprofessionals who have completed teaching licensure programs have stayed on staff at Ruby Bridges waiting for a teacher position to open up rather than leaving for open teaching jobs elsewhere. When you shift in those ways, you create deeper connections for students and staff too. And when you're set up around real belonging, then adults feel like something would be missing. They were gone too, Davis said. You create systems that are less isolated in every way. Congrats to the team at Ruby Bridges. If you're interested to learn more about Ruby Bridges, I spend a good bit of time in chapter 4 of our narrative podcast series, Inclusion Stories, talking about the school and what is happening in Washington around inclusive practices. That's it for this episode of Think Inclusive. Let us know what you thought of this or any episode by emailing me at tvillegas@mcie.org. That's T-V-I-L-L-E-G-A-S at mcie.org. Or find us on Instagram or Threads at think_inclusive. Think Inclusive is written, edited, sound designed, mixed, and mastered by me, Tim Villegas, and is a production of the Maryland Coalition for Inclusive Education. Original music by Miles Kredich. Additional music from Melody. That's melod.ie. Special thanks to our sponsor this week and for the month of April, the Autism Society. Learn more at autismsociety.org. Thanks for your time and attention. And remember, inclusion always works.
I have had guests on that will, they have their microphone like on their desk, and then they'll like hit their desk as they're talking because they're like making a point. And I'm like, Oh, stop.
I've been a telecommuter for about 30 years, and I spent 26 of those years as a box in the middle of a table when everybody else was sitting around the table. Right?
So, oh my gosh.
I'm very used to moderating my own. Well, I've listened to so many people's sandwich papers, you know, rattle right when the person's speaking, and just can't hear anything.
Oh, good stuff. Okay.
From MCIE.